Good morning. My name is Esti Falahi. I'm a professor of pomology at the University of Idaho, and I'm currently vice president for the international division. On behalf of the ASHS, I welcome all of you to the breakfast meeting, and this is one of my favorite parts of the event. And I'm sure you have enjoyed the meeting so far. It has been a great meeting. And I'd like, before I forget anything, to express my deep appreciation to the ASHS staff, people like Tracy Sean and her colleagues, and definitely Mike Neff, for putting a wonderful, wonderful meeting. Those of us who have been on the leadership side, we know that how much effort these people are putting there. And particularly in the last, I would say, 10, 15 years or so, just about any time we contact them as a member, the answer comes back within hours. And if it is related to paper, to payment, whatever it is, and they are the most gentle people to deal with members. I am deeply impressed, and I think that they deserve our appreciation. And then when we see that, we go from room to room, we look at the programs, it takes a lot of hours and energy goes into that. And of course, the program committee puts a lot of effort. And I remember I served on the program committee several years ago, and many of you have. It is not an easy task. It is impossible not to have overlap. So it is not, And I'm honored to see so many people from the leadership of the ESHS here. I'd like to recognize Dr. Arnold, past president, or you are still? He is president. He's always president. He is the chair of the board. And yesterday, in my opinion, he gave a wonderful talk. Wonderful. I think that I talked to many of you. You agreed with me that he started from the way that we are facing with the corporate type universities, and then how we fit as scientists there, and then what is the role of horticulture there. I think that he did a great job. Dr. Fred Davis, and as I mentioned the names, if you just raise your hands. And Dr. Mary Meyer. Mary did a wonderful job, and I had the honor of being with the board and going with them to a number of trips to Washington, D.C., Florida, and other places. And we had a lot of good memories dealing with the lawmakers and how in that 20 minutes that we had, we had to sell our programs for the SCRI and all of those. That was a lot of fun. And of course, my good friend, Dr. Kurt Rome. And I remember that we invited Kurt twice to Idaho. And the first time I invited him, I said, he's another speaker. But I caused a problem for myself. Now our growers every year say, how about Dr. Rome? How about Dr. Rome? When he talks, people just listen to him. He's a great speaker. He is our current president. And also, Dr. Matt Govaggio. Matt, raise your hand. He is our he will be our vice president from this section on, and he will do a great job. This past year, we spent many hours together, and we have come up with some ideas and from the experience that I had. Of course, my term was supposed to be 3 years. And then after my term was expired, shortly after the new vice president took the position, Dr. Jeff Olson, unfortunately, he passed away. And that was a big, a big event for myself, because Jeff has been, he was a friend for many, many years from Oregon State. And then the ASHS asked me to stay for another 3 years, and I did that, and that was a wonderful experience, and I really, truly enjoyed. And I'd like to make one more recognition, and that is John Griffiths. The guy sitting back there, anytime we say John Griffiths, his name is always associated with international. He even looks international, you know, he is. He is such a big asset to our society and particularly to the division. And my favorite part, I mean, we have been writing this newsletter. My most favorite part was when he was sending me a note saying that, Essie, why don't we skip this time? That was a big blessing. I know I love this column, but it was once a month, and then for 6 years, and usually his offer was coming at the time that we had tons of apples to process, and I said, John, I love you. That's great. Wonderful. Today is my honor to introduce our speaker for the breakfast meeting, Professor George Wilson. Professor Wilson is a person, one of my personal role model when I was a lot younger. I remember that the time that I was at Washington State University, this is mid-70s, and then later on at Oregon State, George was one of those people I said, gosh, would it be a day that I can be at the level of that he's contributing to the society and all of that. George is a native of Niagara County in New York. He received his bachelor's degree in pomology/ag econ from Cornell University, and his master's degree from Washington State University, and his PhD from Michigan State University. And the combination that you can't beat, just some of the best universities we have. Then Professor Wilson worked for 9 years as a research scientist on banana and other tropical fruit with the United Fruit Company, which is Chiquita International LLP, in Lima, Cortez, Honduras, and other countries. Then Dr. Wilson joined the Department of Horticulture at North Carolina State University in March of 1975. In 1982, Dean Leggett appointed him as deputy chief of party from the NC State University to the United States Agency for International Development, and that is the organization that's known by USAID. In 2002, George was selected as the senior advisor for the University Relations and Agricultural Research, and then the list goes on and on and on for his wonderful, wonderful, unmatched international activities. And then, not that all of these activities were not enough, he was very busy with post harvest physiology work, and he did tremendous volume of work at the NC-140, and he has been a member of ASHS since 1962, 53 years ago. Yesterday, Jules Janet was recognized to be a member, what, 60, how many, Kurt? 63 years. And I think that George is almost there. 53 years of membership of the ASHS, that's called loyalty. George became the president of ASHS in 2003. Some of you may remember that 2003 has a special significance because that year was the centennial year for the ASHS. And he did tremendous job. I remember that he was so active. As we were having our breakfast, I mentioned to him, and he confirmed that there was a peak on the membership as a result of his activities. And then he was selected fellow of ASHS. Many of you are fellow, and as you know, it is the biggest honor bestowed on members of lifetime achievements. in 1992. Professor Wilson is married to Claudia Wilson, and they have 3 children and 5 grandchildren. And this is the very abbreviated form of George's background. If I wanted even to name everything that he has achieved, it goes a long time. And it is truly my honor, and I should personally thank you so much for accepting our invitation. And I'm sure you remember that people who are retired, and that is not easy to come. And then I checked with the ASHS, we don't have any fund for him to fly here, and he did out of his love and passion to the society, and we are very grateful. With that, please help me to welcome George.
Thank you, Dr. Fellahi, and what you just presented as an introduction is the long version of my resume. I'm really honored to be able to speak with all of you this morning, because I think that any one of you, or many of you that are here this morning, have similar credentials, similar experiences, and you could relate about the challenges and the opportunities in horticulture even better than myself. And you know who you are, and I am depending upon you to be the last part of the program. In other words, I would like to make a few comments, and then I'll turn it over to you. On each of your tables, I have placed a brochure, compliments of Beth Mitchum, Director of the Horticulture Innovation Lab, and this is a very nice presentation of what the Horticulture Innovation Lab is all about and what they are planning to be doing even in the second 5 years of their contract. So I wanted to talk a little bit about innovation labs and how they got started. They started as collaborative research support programs and became innovation labs. And then I wanted to follow up on what President Arnold mentioned yesterday about why horticulture. Horticulture generally has not been included in agricultural development programs around the world. So what you said yesterday, relevance, I think fit right in, and so I've already gotten Mike's permission to quote him. At 11:15 this morning, Beth Mitchum is going to be talking about the impacts of the Horticulture Innovation Lab, so stay tuned for that. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about the challenges, and I think based on some of the comments I heard at lunch yesterday, Beth, I could add a whole lot more challenges to the list, but we'll have sort of a starter set here. So, to me, it's important to be talking about not the graybeards like myself that have been around for all these many years, but about the next generation, and that's why Amanda McWirth is here this morning. She's one of our graduate students at NC State, and she is a part of the Horticulture Innovation Lab. And she will be talking about her experience as a Trellis Fellow. So that's probably more important than what I have to say. And Essie already mentioned that I started my career with United Fruit Company, and in fact I could spend all of my time telling you about the first 2 weeks of my employment, because I started out on the Hudson River in New York City, Pier 3, United Fruit Company. You know it as the World Trade Center. That used to be Pier 3. Well, then we started off for Honduras, and a very long story short, on the way, we came to New Orleans, Well, that's not on the way, but we had a hurricane event, and we survived that. And they said, well, you got to go back where you can get repairs. So we came up the Mississippi River in October of 1963. And I had to go over yesterday morning to Brennan's and have breakfast again the second time. So being here is has a lot of meaning. Some of you may know that there is the Honduran Foundation for International Agricultural Research called FIA in Honduras. And in the days that I was there, that was the Division of Tropical Research of United Fruit Company. All of those facilities were donated to the government of Honduras, and with a $15 million contract, a donation from USAID, it became FIA. And they have succeeded. The facilities have grown. And if any of you, show of hands, anybody been to FIA in Honduras? I know, yeah, good. Well, that was my home for 9 years. For those of you that are not familiar with the CRISP, the Collaborative Research Support Programs, these are unique partnerships between U.S. universities and developing country institutions and USAID. And they were created in 1977 under the Title 12 of the International Development and Food Assistance Act of 1975. Now, that might sound like some trivia, but I think it's important to know that they didn't just start with the Horticulture Innovation Lab. It got a long history. They've had probably 20 different CRISP over the years, and I won't try to name all of them or even tell you the 10 current ones, but I think it's important to know that there is a history, and these have focused on utilizing the scientific expertise of U.S. universities on improving agricultural productivity and marketing systems and enhancing food security in both the U.S. and in the developing countries. Well, now it's called Feed the Future Initiatives. Feed the Future Innovation Labs, but that it's still the same kind of programs. And they really focus on hunger and poverty through science, and the funding is through the Bureau of Food Security at USAID, and often there are buy-ins from the country USAID missions, so that it's not just all coming straight out of Washington, D.C., and it's not just us. So there's a lot of ways to have buy-ins, and often there are matching funds. Mike, when you talked about relevance yesterday, it fits right in with my first topic, and that is the rationale for horticultural research. And you got our attention when you told about $7 billion, $11 billion, who knows what number we might have. That has a lot of implications. There is a close link between the poverty and hunger and malnutrition, and hunger development, horticultural development, offers the opportunity to meet the food needs and at the same time improve nutrition, improve health in the developing world while providing prospects for enhanced income, income diversification, and economic advancement of the rural poor. And this is not just in general, but focusing on women as well as men for the whole system. We're focusing mostly on small producers, small-scale producers, to overcome the barriers in the marketplace, the barriers in production. One of my responsibilities when I was in Washington, D.C., as a university relations advisor to the Office of Agriculture back in 2006 to 2008 was to serve as the only academic or the only non career foreign service officer working on the development of the request for application for the horticulture CRISP. Well, the assessment that had been done prior to that was really led by University of California, Davis, and some of you may have been involved in all of that information gathering process around the world in 7 or 8 different locations. So it came out very clear in the end that you needed to have a horticulture CRISP, not just one that works on fish and wildlife and agronomic issues, but horticulture needed to be there too. Well, another very long story short, University of California, Davis became the management entity starting in 2009. And with my history of involvement and the fact that NC State, the University of Hawaii Manoa, and Cornell University were partners with UC Davis, I became heavily involved in the CRISP or the Innovation Lab as well. In fact, I was there the first chair of the International Advisory Board. And the Horticulture Innovation Lab has supported collaborations with at least 18 U.S. universities, not just the partner institutions, 200 organizations in more than 30 countries in Latin America and Africa and Asia. But they've been doing this in collaboration with partners in the developing countries, and especially those that are under that category of Feed the Future. It's not automatic just because you're a very poor country that you get to be Feed the Future. The local mission through the embassy and through USAID has to develop a plan for Feed the Future initiatives. And the whole idea of these programs is to build the capacity of researchers, the institutions themselves, and the farmers to be able to advance horticultural science. So Beth will tell you more about this in a little while at the next session. But in phase one of the program, these partnerships have improved how nearly 10,000 farmers grow or process or sell their crops. And it has provided for the adoption of new practices and technologies, and it spanned the value chain of fruit and vegetable production and marketing. And I think a good way to summarize that is that in phase one, there was a big emphasis on seeds and germplasm and post-harvest practices and food safety and marketing and capacity building. And some of the current participating projects in phase two are gender equity. We hear a lot about that, but Horticulture Innovation Lab is taking this very seriously, and especially have a project on this in Honduras. Vegetable grafting, projects in Honduras and Guatemala. Nutrition programs in Zambia and Kenya. Irrigation, we have a program in Kenya and Uganda. Conservation agriculture in Cambodia and Nepal. Potato storage, Bangladesh. And then the Innovation Lab has created centers of excellence, one at Zamorano University in Honduras and one at Kasetsart University in Thailand. And we had also attempted to establish one with the National Agricultural Research Institute in Kenya. So the Innovation Lab has annual conferences. In fact, we just had one a couple of months ago. We met in Zambia, and not just the management team, but also all of the principal investigators from the U.S. and their partners from the various countries, plus the International Advisory Board. And my understanding is that we're going to meet again in March 2016, this time in Cambodia. Yesterday, Beth Mitchum met with several of the post-harvest experts to help design some of the post-harvest programs for the last 4 years of the second cycle of the Horticulture Innovation Lab contract. So in addition to the post-harvest, we know that we need to be focusing on the value chain research and innovation and scaling, you know, not just get the innovation, but scale it up, the capacity building, and then the nutrition-sensitive aspects of horticulture, and then sharing this information and getting it out into the hands of the people that can use it. The Trellis Fund, as it's called at the Horticulture Innovation Lab, engages U.S. graduate students in small-scale in-country collaborations around the world. And in the packets that I put on the table, you can see the list of all of the activities, all of the Trellis Fellow activities that are current. But rather than me telling you all about that, I would rather have Amanda McWirt share with you her experience as a Trellis Fellow.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wilson. It was very kind of you to invite me today and give me a few minutes of your time to speak. I do just want to talk really briefly about my experience as a fellow. I was a fellow from 2012 to 2013, which was actually my first year as a PhD student at NC State. I was partnered with an organization in Honduras, in the southeastern region of Honduras, called Promesa Patuca, and it's very near Patuca region. And the goal of that organization is really just to improve the sustainability of agriculture in the region. Primarily, there's corn and beans, cattle, but also some horticultural crops grown there, particularly tomatoes and cucumbers. And my position with the organization was really just to provide guidance, advice, help them find resources. And so during the year-long fellowship, I communicated with them via email and Skype on a pretty much weekly basis, and helping them just kind of guide the organization, particularly because the leaders in the organization were recent college grads, so they're very young and sort of living out in a secluded region of Honduras. And then I was also given the opportunity to go down and visit the organization for about 10 days, and so I got to see all the projects that they were working on. I gave a few talks on biocontrol and IPM in the local high school. It was just a really good experience to actually meet the people that I've been working with and kind of forge relationships. My experience with Hort Trellis was a little bit different from a lot of other graduate students because I had previous experience actually working in Honduras as a Peace Corps volunteer. So I was able to build on that previous experience and understanding of the culture and language. And so it was probably a little bit different from my experience because I already understood the country and the people. But I know from speaking with other graduate students, there was a really great introduction to international work, particularly in horticultural crops. And so I think it's a great opportunity for graduate students in that sense. But for me, it was also just a good opportunity to meet new people down there, particularly some of the organizations. I'm still in contact with all of my collaborators there, and in fact, one of the collaborators came to North Carolina recently and stayed with me. And so I can foresee that this being a good opportunity as I move forward in my career as a faculty member for future collaborations. And so I don't want to take too much of your time, but I think the experience was definitely a rewarding one, and both for me and my collaborators. So thank you so much, Dr. Wilson.
Thank you, Amanda. So she is representing the 52 fellows, Trellis fellows that have participated in these programs so far. And again, there is a listing of all the Trellis fellows, and I've got numbers here of all the training and extension activities that they had and the farmers that they reached, and the fact that the lion's share of the people that participated in these programs over the last few years have been women. And so there's a big emphasis on that. Well, now let's talk about challenges. And I think one of the challenges is really to incorporate gender into the activities. Not just adding it on, or as I read somewhere, to add and stir. You have a project set up and say, oh, by the way, we need to involve the women. Oh, okay, we'll... No. what you do is start from the beginning to facilitate the engagement of the women and their leadership, because in many cases they are the ones that are actually doing all the work. And so you have to do this from the beginning, from the very inception of your project. So that's a challenge. But, and this came out yesterday too, the cultural context. Just because it's women in a developing country doesn't mean that you can use the same model that you did in Honduras when you go to Zambia or Nigeria or Cambodia. Consider what is going on there and how people think, how they interact. Not to take anything away from the male counterparts, but consider all of these constraints and be attentive to the interactions between the men and the women and the cultural dimensions. All too often, I think we go into developing countries and we feel like we've got some answers. If you just pay attention to me, I'm going to solve your problems. And I think it's the other way around. If you pay attention to the folks that you have been sent to work with, they're going to solve their own problems. And you listen to them, because they've been doing it. They've been living the life. And I usually come away from these experiences, and I think a lot of you would agree, with learning much more than I contributed. So there's a real learning experience, and especially with this business of the gender equity. Because you do need to have a meaningful relationship or participation of the women, not just saying, okay, we got our women, we can check that off, no problem. Make it meaningful and be aware of the fact that there are different roles for the men and the women. And also identify all of the resources that are needed to implement whatever your activity is. And make sure that women do have access to these resources, and be attentive to the barriers that are going to face the women as they try to be a part of the program. And identify who's going to actually benefit. And beware of the empowerment gap. I'm not sure exactly what all that means, but I think that you're empowering women to be able to do more for their families. And again, they are on the ground. They have been dealing with these issues, and their family is going to benefit more by them being given more authority, more power, more engagement. Sensitize the men in the community to the benefits of engaging the women. Us guys don't need to be threatened. We know how powerful the women are, and we know how important they are, but it's not true of all cultures. So when the women are actually empowered, the entire household and the community benefits. So make them equal partners. And someday I think, Beth, we're going to be getting together at these meetings to say, what happened to all the men? We need to re-empower the men. We need to get them engaged. The women have taken over. And when you're developing these projects and you're talking about gender issues, not only should you plug in the gender issues from the beginning, but consider getting a gender specialist. We're horticulturists, maybe marketing specialists and physiologists and breeders, but we're not the specialist in gender. Scalability. I think it's usually important to consider scaling up products of the research and development activities and incorporating these into the innovations of the local and the regional systems. But scalability, I think, is not something that you can add on later on. I think you need to have this in place from the beginning so that you have a plan for scalability, even though not everything can be scaled up. And it's similar to what I just said about the gender issues. And as you do look at the scalability, the scaling up phases, make sure that you involve the private sector as much as you can and the local institutions. In terms of development opportunities, I think that USAID should be investing even more in innovations in horticulture to be able to truly transform agriculture. It can't just be with big agriculture and with the staple items, the rice, the wheat, and things like that. And the Horticulture Innovation Lab, in my view, is very well positioned, has demonstrated their effectiveness and their impacts, so they're ready to lead this kind of effort. Well, how about collaborations and development? There's all kinds of non-government organizations and other organizations that are operating in the countries where you might have had some experiences. And collaboration is usually not characteristic of their projects. They'd be operating over here. It's like we had, you know, all five of these tables, and each one of you is operating independently, and you've got a great program here and a great program there. What about the possibility of taking these silos and unifying some of these efforts for greater efficiency and greater effectiveness? In fact, while we were working in Guatemala and Honduras a few years ago with the Hort Innovation Lab, I proposed that we find a way for the government to actually unify these efforts and formalize the unification of some of these efforts and actually to be able to get more out of it. And then when you choose your in-country collaborators and collaborating institutions, I think that it's very, very important to vet completely, as thoroughly as possible, who these possible partners might be, who these individuals might be. Know in advance what their track records are, and avoid entering into agreements based on limited background information. And sometimes you're using your friends, and you say, well, good old Charlie Brown, he'll do a good job, he always has. Well, it may not work out that way when you get into the unique framework of the contract or the kind of needs that you have. And some of the other considerations are the flexibility. I think somebody in this room will be talking about flexibility in a couple of hours, and would that be you, Mr. Shark? Yeah. So it's important to be flexible, to be creative, and then you have to also consider the politics of where you are and where you might be going. And what about extension programs? We know that extension is pretty vital here in the United States. But when you get into developing countries, often extension is non-existent. Or it's there, but it's government, and they're really not doing very good jobs. But with all of these operations that are going on, the projects, the programs, the faith-based programs, the government programs, the international programs, there's a whole lot of extension-like activities and technology transfer going on. And again, why can't we unify them through the Ministry of Agriculture? I think they have a good opportunities to be able to get more bang for their buck by getting these folks together. And consulting opportunities. You guys have done a great job. SEU and John have been telling people about all these opportunities. And again, when you get involved in these opportunities that you guys have been informing us all about. Again, flexibility, very, very important. Patience, listening. Be innovative. Things aren't always going to be the way you thought they would be when you signed on for this project. Feed the future. I won't even list the countries. There are 19 Feed the Future countries, and that's where the innovation labs have to focus their efforts. But there are a lot of other countries that may not have subscribed to Feed the Future initiatives and don't have a plan, but there may also be countries that you could be working in. And I could go on for a long time about reducing post-harvest losses. I call it the elephant in the room. With the population increases you're talking about, Mike, I wonder sometimes if we're really making progress, or do we just continue to talk about it, Or can we really make a difference in post-harvest? And that's why we had this conversation at lunch yesterday. You can't just go into the training program and feel like you've automatically gotten everybody into selling and using more of what they're producing. So, and oftentimes it's probably easier to get funding for research on development and research on post-harvest needs than it is to put the money down on the line to do some training and get the stuff off the shelves that we already know. Sustainability. I think when you start these projects, you need to have an exit strategy. Work yourself out of a job. Sometimes I think that some careers are actually maintained in as development professionals. People can go from project to project, maybe even in the same country, in the same community, and maybe sometimes as consultants, you just keep wiring these things together. And when I was on a plane coming out of South Sudan a couple of years ago, I was sitting next to a gentleman that was working with an organization. I can't remember the name now, but I asked him how long he'd been doing this, and several decades. And I said, that's kind of a profession, isn't it? I said, aren't there a lot of people that might be on this plane here in this terribly dysfunctional country that are really making a good living off of the needs of these countries? Because these are not cheap folks. They're not all volunteers. Some of them are highly paid professionals. He smiled and he said, we call it doing well by doing good. Doing well by doing good. Now, maybe I might be stepping on some toes here, so maybe some of you really take advantage of some of those situations too. Well, one last thought that I wanted to mention is that when you get into the actual country and on the functional level with USAID programs, that's a part of the USA diplomatic mission. That's their program, and you're part of that program. And so at the embassy level, they're very interested in having a presence throughout the country, out in the provinces. So back in the 80s, when we had a USAID contract for agricultural development in Peru, I got a little cynical toward the end of my assignment there, and I kind of felt like, you know, if I just grab that American flag and stick it in the ground and hold on for dear life, the guys at the embassy are going to be happy. Whether we had any impact or not, they had a presence out there in the corners of the country. Surely they appreciated it, and we were able to produce good results, but physical presence, I think often means a great deal. So, now it's your turn. And I know that those of you here in this room have more experiences than I have, so now I'm going to turn it over to you to correct me on some of my statements. Beth has been here cringing, hoping I wouldn't say anything stupid about the innovation labs. So, your turn. My handy-dandy brains in my pocket died this morning. Just unceremoniously, unmercifully died, and I can't even call home. So thanks to Amanda, she let me call one of my children to say, Dad's okay. Mike.
I'm just kind of curious, as Dan, you alluded to the post-harvest issues. How do you see the distribution systems in developing countries being a concern as you go through? I'm just curious what your experiences have been.
Distribution of what, Mike?
Once we've produced the crops and have a way to potentially keep them, how do they get from where they're being produced to where they're actually needed? Is that usually not a problem? Is it all local, or is that an issue?
That's an issue. Any of you that have been in these developing countries know that infrastructure is sometimes a myth. not very many very good roads, especially out in the places where they're producing these crops. So, okay, so you've got the technology, you've got the refrigerated vehicles to maintain the temperatures and get them trained not to overload the vehicles by a factor of two or three. But then getting to the market, it's a pretty rough trip. So unless we can go in and build wonderful roads to all of these places, getting to the market is definitely a challenge, a real problem.
So is the emphasis then being on more local and not having to ship, or are we trying to work on ways to enhance the shipping capabilities?
Yes. I think with the, Beth can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think part of the emphasis in the Horticulture Innovation Lab programs has been for local markets, because we haven't even satisfied them in maintaining the quality of the products and getting into those markets. So, but still, you need to have facilities, equipment, and Beth is going to be talking about some of those impacts. Some small-scale refrigeration systems where you can convert air conditioners into refrigeration storages. Yeah. Well, another thought on that is that in the marketing sometimes and in the transportation, there are standards that are established by local buyers and sellers that may not be compatible with the best interests of the crop that you're trying to ship. For example, I remember in Dominica, I saw these boxes of melons, I believe it was. Maybe it was banana. It doesn't matter what the product was. But the box was about yay big, and here's the top of the box. But they had filled it all the way up about, you know, a foot to 15 inches higher, and then wrapped it in paper and tied it down. I said, what's going on? Say, well, what we do is pack them up that way, and then we lay them on their sides, and then I said, well, why do you have to do that? Well, because you pay by the box, and here's the box. So you make the box very, very big by adding on to it, so you have like 30 or 40% more. If you could only find a way to get to those people that establish those standards and say, okay, let's get real about this. And there you're getting into local politics and culture and economics. And I saw a hand here.
Yeah. Okay, just a general comment. Certainly there's a huge infrastructure problem, and that's not going to go away. The Chinese are doing a pretty good job right now of of building infrastructure, of building roads for all of us who travel, and that's going to be helping. But one of the real mega trends going on in the next 15 years is the fact that 60% of us are going to be urban. And this urbanization, entire urbanization, is happening fastest in the developing world. And I think, still we're going to have to be, you're going to have to look at issues of post-harvest and what have you, and shipability and cultural changes and get better packaging systems and what have you. But the whole fact that we're becoming more urban really favors horticulture, because I think a huge problem in the past has been, and you alluded to this, George, is that AID, for instance, would really emphasize the agronomic crops. Well, nobody can make money on corn, rice, and wheat unless they have hectares and hectares. And that really favors horticulture because the farm's getting closer to the pork. And that's a huge plus for horticulture. And I think we have to be very innovative in the developing world of looking at even controlled environment agriculture, very simplified things which are appropriate for the areas. And I think that's a huge opportunity for us in horticulture, particularly in the developing world. And I think that's something really AID, I think, needs to look much more closely at that too, is the urbanization, because that to me is really where the future's at and everything. And looking at developing cultural systems, production systems, smaller units and what have you, and some of that is going on right now. That's a huge opportunity for us, for young people who are looking at opportunities for research and getting into international development.
Yes, please.
Well, as our colleague had mentioned, study had a top in urban and peri-urban agriculture article. I think by 2050, 70% of urban areas will have a and that is put, which I did propose for the last 10 years, is to emphasize on urban and peri-urban agriculture. And there, agriculture plays the most important role. So grains and legumes are not so important. So this is so peri-urban agriculture. This is the greatest of our job between urban and peri-urban, which is very important. And then I'm stopping to Mike. One of the challenges is to agriculture. Agriculture is a major contributor of nutrition for all.
So how do you, at a programmatic level, capitalize on the benefits of horticulture? And that's the challenge of the innovation labs. It's almost mind-boggling to be able to get your head around it and to be able to channel horticulture into the food systems, the value chain, so that you can end up feeding more people as they get further and further away from producing their own crops. Mike.
Kind of gets back to the question about being able to move the produce from the rural environments where it's being produced into the urban areas. I wonder, has anybody done any work with coming up with generic crates or packaging that could be versatile for a number of crops that you might design a smaller trailer or something to fit onto the motorcycles or the bikes or anything like that, where it could be standardized and you could sell them, it would adapt to a number of the crops and maybe buffer themselves from the damage to the root.
I think the thing that most people look to, and I think has a lot of potential, are these returnable plastic containers. In fact, there's a local company in Tanzania now that's producing these. That's the first time I've seen that produced in a developing country. But you have to look to see if you can come up with a way of revisiting these. How do you get them back to the origin, and how do you keep them losing them? Because they obviously have lost them. So you have to look into the socioeconomic.
But it's almost on a country by country, region by region basis. One size that fits all. It's probably a fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Like for tomatoes, in a lot of countries, they do use plastic crates. I've seen that in Senegal and Ghana. So they haven't made them anywhere. Probably based on the value of the crop, perhaps. I do know that also there's more men who grow tomatoes in Senegal.
Mm-hmm.
The question I have is that political issues that we are facing basically everywhere for Westerners, particularly from the United States and their presence just about everywhere. Next week I'm going to be in Istanbul, just in a few days, for the ISHS meeting, and there is a concern among all members about the 2018 meeting and then some of the threat by ISIS and other groups. And I was wondering that with all this wonderful work that you are doing, is that something that could be even a more major concern in the future?
Well, I mean, security is always a concern for us. We do have the flexibility that if we ever feel that having our USAID on projects is a problem, we're allowed to not put it on there if it's going to make us a target or somehow have a negative implication. I haven't, you know, the countries, the future countries are all countries that the United States has good working relationships with. They're welcoming us in there. It doesn't mean the entire population is, but I haven't really felt sort of anti-Americanism in the places that we're working at yet. But, you know, probably because those countries have a tighter relationship with the United States, they're not, most of them aren't in conflict with us over political issues.
You're absolutely right. Those countries particularly, they have been less of concern. But, you know, this threat, it seems to be increasing by the day, you know.
Right. I mean, security is a huge issue. And
right.
The last round of our contracting, they had us add funds in there for security so that we have the ability to hire security personnel or pay for things for security. And, you know, there's a few countries on the list that are very dangerous to travel to, so we try to be.
Dr. Rung, you had a question? I remember that I had an assignment to Afghanistan several years ago, and there was a genuine concern about having mines, unexploded mines, in vineyards. And that was quite an experience. You had a question, please.
This is always a concern when you travel out of the United States to any other place. So, of course, the Department of State has state warning for
yes.
All Americans. Okay. But looking at the changing world now with all the terrorism, because I work in Afghanistan over the last 8 years, in Pakistan, and Nepal and other countries, I can
expansion is happening very fast, and it's a very unpredictable. So of course, for any international travel, you have to consider those possibilities.
You're right.
And then that can happen. But most of the future countries were selected because I was one of the leading initiators. All the talks was happening that how do we scale it in a protected areas, most of the country. And that's why Afghanistan was on the list initially, and it went out. There are other countries has been also completely. Mali was mm-hmm. taken off. And then there was another country, I think,
Libya.
Mongolia for different reasons.
It's Libya and North Korea, they have been on the list, yeah.
So I think for the most of the innovation lab countries are pretty safe. Unpredictable, like earthquake in Nepal happens.
Yeah.
Disaster can happen. There are the group of buyers who work in Nepal also, which can kidnap you for ransom. There is a possibility like this, but most of other countries are safe.
Thank you very much. Before I make a very important announcement or recognition, I would like, this is something I should have done at the beginning of the session, if you would please introduce yourself from here very quickly. I think most everybody knows each other, but if you go just around the table starting, I don't know who you are, Beth. Thank you. Clint.
Clint Schock, I'm the director of Oregon State University's Malheur Experiment Station, close to Essen.
Is that a positive or negative?
It's a positive.
Thank you.
My name is Ajit, and I'm the director of the Institute of Global Ag and Technology Transfer Institute. It was initially part of our state, but now it's an independent organization and working for the world.
Thank you. Great.
I'm Shara Krishnan. I'm director of horticulture at the Denver Botanic Gardens, and I also run our Connected Global Initiative. And my research focus is looking at coffee, looking at the genetic and global.
Thank you. Amanda, you did a great job. I'm so proud of you that you came. I really appreciate that. It was a good feeling to see a graduate student is talking so calmly. And so you did a wonderful job. I really appreciate that you came. Thank you. Matthew?
Yes, Matthew
from USDA. Matthew, I practiced your name, I have to admit, several times. And then before having the honor of knowing you, I thought Falahi is one of the most difficult names. But I feel it's so much better. And we are really delighted that you're coming at the leadership of the ASHS, and I'm sure you will do a wonderful job.
Dinero Fazio, USDA RS and Cornell University in New York. I work on apple boost stocks, and my interest in international horticulture has expanded quite a bit as apples are cultured in a lot of places in the world, and we have some of the best food stuffs around for disease resistance. So I've been able to experience some amazing beautiful places in the world where they're beginning to grow apples.
For those of you who are not in fruit, in the area of fruit, what Dr. Fazio and Dr. Robinson and Dr. Lelan Cheng and their group, they are doing in New York, It has a global ramification and positive effect in all aspects of the fruit rootstock particularly, and they are doing a fantastic job and with the Geneva and Cornell rootstocks. Please.
I'm Takashi Hirakui, working for Meiji University in Japan. I was a presenter of this division in 2011 at Hawaii.
Wow.
I hope they will remember me.
Great.
Good morning, Brian Irish. I'm a genetic resources manager of tropical fruit crops in Maya West Puerto Rico for the USDA ARS, working on cacao and bananas, and I relate a lot to your presentation. My mother works for Chiquita in Costa Rica, where I'm from. My father works with USAID, and I've done a lot of volunteer assignments in a developing country.
There's a stranger
and
there. Go ahead.
I'm Chris Walsh. I'm at the University of Maryland. I do production and post-harvest in fruits and vegetables. I've probably worked in about 40 countries in the world, mostly Spanish-speaking. Very interested in what's going on in Central America. I would make two comments. One is, as far as the standard packaging container, it's a Washington State apple box being recycled.
Yeah.
You find them all over the world. What do they pay? A buck and a quarter, a buck and a half of glasses. Those things go through a lot of cycles.
Yeah.
Most of what I do is food safety training. And what I've noticed in response to what you were talking about in the urbanization, a lot of people, we go with Food and Drug Administration to do international food safety training. And in fact, although the emphasis is on improving the food safety for American consumers, many of the smaller farmers are shipping just within the country from the countryside to the capital city. And I don't know why the banana companies are willing to run $300,000 tractor trailers over those roads, but they do it too. So it's amazing what moves in lots of places on horrible road conditions.
Great. Thank you very much, Chris. Dr. Davis? Yeah.
I'm Fred Davies. I'm at Texas A&M University, and I've had a long time interest in international horticulture and agriculture. I got into horticulture because I was backpacking around the world, and backpacking around the world, I backpacked with a good friend as a horticulturist. And one of the things I saw in traveling through the Americas and through Africa and through Asia was the niche opportunities in horticulture as high value crops, and those opportunities are as great today as they were back then. And I've had the luxury of working in Peru and Mexico and also in Indonesia on Fulbright fellowships and with universities and research institutions. And I had the luxury actually of this past year of working at the Jefferson Science Hall of the Bureau of Food Security at USAID, and that's something I really think we should have more of our horticulturists involved in doing, because it's an opportunity to work in the State Department or work at USAID and get involved in policy. And I know George has been very active in that area over the years as well too, and I think we really need to get more horticulture on the landscape. And as Beth mentioned, it has really picked up a lot, and the nutritionists understand the importance of horticulture and what have you, and so I think there are tremendous opportunities out here.
For those of you who are receiving SCRI or block grant in any form or shape, I think you should know that Fred had a great deal of influence, or he did a lot of talking along with other board members, with those lawmakers in Washington, D.C., and we really appreciate that. And remember that the way that that few minutes that we had, the statements you were making were so convincing, and we hope that, I'm sure that it made a big difference. Kurt?
Kurt Rowan, Professor of Horticulture at the University of Arkansas, and Associate Dean of the Graduate School for International Education and International Programs, and was a senior Fulbright lecturer at the University of Padova, Italy.
Thank you.
I'm Marlene Marsh. I'm at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. I currently am involved in organic and sustainable agriculture research. On the other end, from the students, I've done a few short-term set of broad trips with students to different places.
Welcome, thank you. Mike, of course.
Mike Turner, Texas A&M, and I'm here for ASHS Board to learn more about international issues.
Thank you for coming. John?
John Griffiths, the entire horticulture faculty of Florida Gulf Coast University.
They offered me an adapt chair, which was nice, but so they put it on chair on my business card, so people think I'm the chairman of a whole department, so it works well. Anyway, research interests tend to be underutilized tropical fruits in the new introduction to ornamentals. And fortunately, I'll be doing a Fulbright, so if anyone finishes that opportunity, I'll be doing a Fulbright starting next month in Turkey. So,
thank you.
We'll put an interesting opportunity to figure out how all that works.
Thank you, John. John is the only one that I know. He can find internet in the middle of jungle. Sometime when I receive his email, he said, "Essie, I managed to find internet in such an item." My goodness, these guys are. Dr. Klincha has a brief comment. Before doing that, I'd like to present a certificate to our distinguished speaker. Dr. Wilson, on behalf of the American Society for Horticultural Science, the ASHS International Division International Distinguished Award is hereby presented to L. George Wilson in recognition of his lifetime contributions to the International Division of the ASHS for his outstanding keynote presentation, August 6, 2015, signed by President Michael Arnold and ASHS International Division Vice President Ismail Falahi. That's my honor to present this to you.
But you prepared those comments before you heard me speak.
You have,
30
seconds?
Yeah, maybe 60 seconds.
Okay.
The folks that go out into our profession do that because they have a vision of what they want to serve others. And they usually have a love of plants or love of nature, and combine that love of nature and desire to serve other people. And really, the way that we make ourselves whole or make the world whole is by pouring ourselves out into what we want to do, what we want to make happen in the world. The members of this society and all the people here really need to be thanked, because you end up doing lots of things for free. There's lots of services, both to the society and, you know, somebody that calls from who knows where that needs something. It's not really part of your job, but you do that because you just have a love for what you're doing and what it's all about. Inadvertently, without really being the intent, some of us do well. Because the results of what we create over our careers brings a demand for who we are and what we can provide. There's nothing, you know, it's not what we're asking for or what we're demanding, but what we end up earning. There's nothing to be ashamed of that, because the money that you receive or the income that you have can help support your family, and it gives one the opportunity to have excess resources that you can reinvest in other grants or foundations or kids programs or other things. So continue to pour yourself out.
Thank you. Thank you. Of course, Clint, you have done tremendous service to the onion industry, potato industry, and the whole high desert crops in the Southwest. And all of those aside, I really love your barbecues that you offer once in a while, and those are so delicious. Thank you all, and have a wonderful day, and have a safe journey. Thank you.